From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Phil Mendelson. He is chair of the D.C. Council. And we'll also be talking with Ralph Northam, the lieutenant governor of Virginia, who is now the Democratic nominee to be the governor of Virginia. If you have questions for Ralph Northam, you can start calling now, 800-433-8850. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream there, ask a question or comment, send us a tweet at Kojo Show or email to kojo@wamu.org. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, the issue of women going topless on the beach in Ocean City, there was an advisory letter that came from the Office of Maryland Attorney General Brian Frosch telling Ocean City officials that, yes, they could sanction women who were going topless on the beach. I felt that there was no legal opinion offered by the Attorney General himself. I wondered why Brian Frosch apparently wanted to stay out of this, but that's another story. But what does this all mean?
Well, first of all, if I can defend the Attorney General for a moment, I don't think he's staying out of it. It's routine, I think, for his assistant attorneys general to write these letters around. But his name is on the letterhead. I have the letter in front of me.
Okay, so that clarifies that.
The issue was that there's been an increasing number of women who are on the beach at Ocean City, and they're not breastfeeding, but they're just simply exposing their breasts to the sun just like men do. And there was some concern. Some other bathers complained to police, and police were kind of unsure what to do or what to say. So they asked the Attorney General for an opinion. And the opinion was that it was within the constitutional rights and the laws of the Maryland that you could ask women to cover their breasts in public. Now, a lot of people have joked about this. Oh, this is how funny it's been. You know, this is an issue that a lot of women and a lot of people don't joke about. Why can't they just simply be on the beach like men? So, but the laws are there, and I think that this would require some type of suit to overturn.
Well, the laws are there, but one wonders what the sanctions are. One wonders what the penalty would be for violating the law.
Oh, it's a misdemeanor. I mean, it's we won't read the three pages of legalese here, but he saw the counsel to the General Assembly, Sandra Benson Brantley, and Adam Snyder, who's the chief counsel for opinions and advice, cite several legal cases, Supreme Court cases, and Maryland cases, saying that it's within the rights of the authorities to limit the exposure of women's breasts on beaches.
Okay, we can move on, because this week we did a segment on the lawsuit filed by the Attorneys General of Maryland and the District of Columbia against the President of the United States, claiming that he is in violation of the Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution because he's been accepting millions in payments and benefits from foreign governments since moving into the White House. Those two Democrat attorney generals were in agreement. A third in this region significantly wasn't, and that would be the Commonwealth of Virginia. Do you know, Tom Sherwood, why Virginia was not involved in this lawsuit?
There's been no public discussion of that. I've read a lot about this, and I was at the press conference where the two attorneys general spoke, and they were asked, were there others? And they said they have reached out to other attorneys general, including Republican ones, to join them in this suit. But there was no mention of the Attorney General Mark Herring of Virginia. It sounds like something he would be happy to be involved in, but he also is running in the midst of his reelection campaign. But not that he would be politically a coward to do this. I just think maybe he had other issues. I mean, some people could say, given all the issues in Maryland and all the issues in the District of Columbia, is this a wise course, and is it really necessary for the Attorneys General here to challenge the Trump's getting money and other types of things from his private business as vice president?
Well, we know that people get busy when they're running political campaigns, and I guess that was also the case for our guest, Ralph Northam. He is the lieutenant governor of Virginia. He won the primary to become the Democratic nominee in this year's November's governor's race. He joins us by phone. Mr. Lieutenant Governor, thank you for joining us, and congratulations on your win.
Hello, Kojo and Tom, and it's great to be on your show, and hope you are well as your listeners.
You know, I was there at election night in Crystal City. I was tweeting in the big crowd there where you burst in, and you had the governor of Virginia there with you. You had the two senators, Mark Warner and Tim Kaine. You had a number of other people up there speaking for you. You won. You turned back Tom Perriello, who had based his campaign on being anti-Trump. You chose to meet him on that road, and you were also very clearly anti-Trump. What does it mean going into the general election with Ed Gillespie, who's the nominee for the Republican Party, and now you're going to try to hang Trump around his neck?
Well, first of all, Tom, thank you for being there, and I understand it was a little warm in there for your liking, and I just
That's correct.
Wanted to let you know, we as Democrats are fiscally responsible, and we also are environmentally conscious, so we asked them to not use a lot of electricity, so I hope it didn't shorten your stay.
And you also picked a space that I know is right around the corner from your campaign office too. That's why you were there. It's very difficult for me to get there and park too, so I'm going to send you my parking bill.
Mr. Lieutenant Governor, allow me to ask Tom a question. How does Ralph Northam know that you were uncomfortably hot?
Well,
complain?
I might have mentioned that it was warm in the room and that I had to take my jacket off,
He complained.
I call it pointing out.
Well, before go ahead,
I'm
please.
I'm glad you were there, and I was going to just address your question. And
okay, please
you
do.
You know, it was a good day for our party and certainly for our team. And we're very proud, and just we've had a lot of grassroots support over the last years, and they turned out for us on Tuesday, so we were very pleased, and now are looking forward to November. And to your point, there is a lot of anti-Trump, anti-Washington sentiment in Virginia. I think that energy and enthusiasm will continue, and we'll certainly harness that and hopefully take it to the polls. In November, I would still tell you that Virginians are looking for a leader who, knows how to get things done in Richmond, has the experience, has the relationships, and that's what we bring to the table. And I think, Virginia spoke to that on Tuesday.
Do you know Ed Gillespie at all? I know he's been mainly a national Republican figure. He did have that campaign against Mark Warner in 2014 where he nearly beat him. Just as Tom Perriello had more of a national orientation in his politics, Mr. Gillespie has too.
I don't know him, Tom. I just know that he's a Washingtonian lobbyist with a Virginia address, and we're certainly going to talk about Virginia values and again experience and being a native, having grown up on the Eastern Shore. I understand Virginia and have been working for Virginia over the last 10 years. So we'll certainly make that a large part of our message moving forward.
One last, put on your analyst hat. Corey Stewart, who a lot of people just wrote off, and I think Mr. Gillespie had written him off, didn't take him seriously maybe. But Corey was on this program several times. I went out into Prince William County and other places with him and saw him in action. He got a very strong vote, whether you like his politics, what he did or didn't do. He seemed, as Governor McAuliffe said Tuesday night, he made the Republicans have a very long night. What were your thoughts about Corey Stewart's surprising showing?
Well, I think there's a tremendous contrast between what Corey Stewart stands for and certainly what Ralph Northam and the Democratic Party stands for. But, some of the fear-mongering that he's, I think, learned from our current president is certainly something that is not welcome in Virginia. I think him going back to the Civil War days and promoting statues that just fall in line with the hatred and the bigotry and certainly the racial tensions we have are not in the best interest of Virginians. So while, people like Corey Stewart bring that forward, the Democratic Party, we have a large tent and we bring hope to Virginia. We want to make sure that, all Virginians have jobs. That they can support themselves and their families. They want health care. They want to have world-class education for their children. So, while he's busy talking about statues and immigration issues that are unrealistic, we're talking about hope and promise for Virginia.
He's not that busy talking about that anymore because he lost, but I'm going to repeat Tom's question. Why do you think he did so well among Republican voters?
I don't know, but I know that Democrats aren't interested in that message, and it's going to have nothing to do with what we're, you know, fighting for in Virginia. So, again, we're promoting jobs and health care and education and inclusivity, and that's something that, you know, Governor McAuliffe and Mark Herron and I have been very proud of. We're a welcoming Commonwealth, and we want to have our lights on and our doors open to folks that want to come here and live and raise their families and work in Virginia.
Allow me to have you put your analyst's hat on yet again, because yours was a hard-fought campaign. You and Tom Perriello were neck and neck in the polls. In the end, you won by a wider margin than the polls had suggested after all the pundits and all the speculation. What factors do you think contributed to the margin of your victory?
Well, I think certainly, again, my experience, Kojo, and just the fact that I have, you know, been in Virginia and served in the Senate and in the lieutenant governor's position, and, you know, just having traveled around. I mean, I think I told you when I was on your show last time, we've made over 180 appearances in the last couple of years for delegates and senators and even folks running at the local level. So, you know, people got to know me. They were comfortable with me. And I think they just, you know, saw that my experience is important. I know how to get things done in Richmond, and they came out for us on Tuesday.
Your ads in the closing days noted here, particularly here in Northern Virginia, where there was some like 30% in the public polling, undecided voters, that the Washington Post editorial sided with you, said something nice about Frank Wagner on the Republican side, but acknowledging he wasn't a seriously challenging candidate to win the Republican nomination, but gave you a firm endorsement. Was that a big factor, a factor?
Well, I certainly think it was important. And, you know, also, Tom, what I would say is just to have the, you know, every Democratic legislator and certainly the governor and attorney general and both U.S. senators, to have them endorse me and, you know, to reach out to their voters and really make them feel that they were, you know, in tune with my leadership, you know, skills and where I wanted to take Virginia. That, all of that was very helpful. So, you know, a lot of things came together for us there at the end. And again, I think you saw the results of that on Election Day.
I think we probably could have started with this. I want to just back up for a moment and ask you, as a potential leader of the state, you had the horrific shooting in Alexandria this week of the congressman. Obviously, you have been fairly strong on the gun control issues. I think you proposed that the state reinstitute the one gun a month law that Governor Wilder had. But obviously can't stop every crime from happening. But right. What was your overall thought about several days now after that shooting on a ball field in Alexandria?
Well, Tom, you know, if tragedy, and as President Obama said, how many more times do we have to talk about these types of tragedies? I will take just a minute to compliment the law enforcement that was there and I think saved a lot of lives with their heroic efforts. What I would say is that, you know, we always talk about offering our thoughts and prayers to these families, but I think, and that's wonderful, I think that's good, but I think we need to honor these folks with action now. And we do need to sit down at the table with folks from both sides of the aisle and talk about responsible gun ownership and what we can do to make our society safer. And just as you mentioned, we used to have one gun a month in Virginia. That worked very well. Now we have a pipeline from Virginia, not only that disperses weapons in Virginia, but goes up to New York. The great majority of Virginians believe in universal background checks. So I think that we can sit people at the table from both sides of the aisle and say, look, you know, we've got a challenge out there. We don't need to keep hearing of these tragedies. And let's talk about how we can promote responsible gun ownership in Virginia. And, you know, certainly coming from rural Virginia, I think I'm in a good position to do that.
Do you think this tragedy will give the issue momentum in the gubernatorial race? It hasn't in the past. The shootings at Virginia Tech did not seem to give the issue momentum. What do you think you and your campaign can do at this point to give an issue that you favor more momentum in a race in which the opposing party would not be interested in discussing it?
Well, I think that, Kojo, that I think they need to be interested, because this shouldn't be a partisan issue. And just like we want responsible folks behind the wheel of a automobile. We want the people that are having access to firearms in Virginia to be responsible as well. That's not asking for too much. That's what all Virginians support. And again, I think it's a discussion that if we bring people to the table and find areas that we can agree on, it's something that we can certainly have a good discussion on and do things that will make our streets safer.
Here is Grant in Warrenton, Virginia. Grant, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Coach, how are you today?
I'm well.
Good, good. This question is for Mr. Northam. I am a millennial. I voted for Tom Perriello because he, you know, stands for progressive values. So my question to you is, what are you going to do to appeal to, you know, voters like me who think these progressive, you know, issues are important to us? How are you going to appeal to that crowd?
Well, Grant, I appreciate the question, and I would just tell you, as a doctor, I tend to be a good listener, I hope, and I tend to like to hear what's on people's minds. And so what we have promoted, you know, during the campaign and really over the last 10 years of my public service is what I would refer to as progressive realism. And that is, you know, talking about progressive democratic values that people like you feel very strongly about it, and starting with, you know, good jobs and access to health care, access to world-class education, being good stewards of our environment. Those are all progressive democratic values. And as I said in my speech on Tuesday night, I'm an admirer of Tom Perriello. He's a wonderful public servant, and I will do everything that I can over the next days, weeks, and months to achieve or gain your support. And so I ask all the Democrats in Virginia to, you know, come under the tent. We're in this together, and the prize right now, what we need to focus on is November the 7th.
Tom Perriello called you to congratulate you. He pledged to work to elect you in November. Do you expect him to work to make sure people like Grant come over to your camp?
I think that, you know, Tom and I have always had a great relationship. We did have a very nice conversation Tuesday night, and we'll be spending a lot of time this weekend. Our JJ dinner is here in Richmond, and he's actually graciously reached out and has offered to introduce me at the dinner. So I'm looking forward to seeing Tom and having further discussion with him. And to Grant's question, we need to all work together as Democrats to bring everybody under the tent and focus on November. It's going to be a tremendous amount of attention on Virginia, and we're going to lead the way in this country to show folks, you know, the strength and the power and what we do as Democrats.
I hope I won't be able to be there. I have other obligations, but I'll check to see if Tom Perriello mentions anything about gas pipelines when he introduces you. That was the one thing that, you know, you got hammered on from him constantly in a race that otherwise was quite Virginia gentlemanly on the pipeline issue. I don't think you're going to have that issue come up much with Ed Gillespie, but you know, some of those progressives who are for Tom Perriello specifically like that issue. Do you plan on a general election change in what you say about those pipelines that you said during the primary?
No, I don't think we're going to change, Tom, but what I do want to do is reach out to those folks. I mean, we had some protesters, as you know,
yes,
there in Crystal City Tuesday night. And so, you know, Pam, my wife, is she works for a nonprofit environmental group, and the two of us plan to reach out and work with these folks and do everything that we can. As we've said in the past, that if this moves forward, to make sure that it's done with science and transparency. And so I look forward to continuing that dialogue with folks across Virginia that are concerned about the challenge and issue. And I agree with them. It is something we need to focus on and pay attention to, and I plan to listen to those folks.
Speaking of dialogues, debates. You had Mr. Gillespie had a few debates with Corey Stewart, Mr. Wagner. You certainly had your fair share of debates with Tom Perriello. Are you planning, how will you approach debating Mr. Gillespie? Do you plan debates all around the state? What do you hope to do there so we'll know, and hope, of course,
you'll be
here.
And do you hope to debate him on this broadcast?
On this broadcast, WAMU, we hope.
Oh, I think that'd be a great idea, because, you know, you have so many listeners. I mean, that's just a way to reach out to folks, so I say that seriously, but I look forward to debating Mr. Gillespie and talking about things like his tax plan, which is totally irresponsible, his agreeing with Mr. Trump on the health care plan that will put 23 million Americans at risk to lose their coverage, talking about the environment. I know that he agrees with President Trump pulling out of the Paris Agreement. We'll talk about access to women's reproductive health care. We'll talk about Virginia being an inclusive state, which is something that I've advocated for. So I don't know the schedule of debates, but I look forward to having those as we approach November.
And we've invited Mr. Gillespie a number of times during the primary campaign and continue to invite him to come on the show even as a single guest. So thank you very much.
You plan to start campaigning right away with the Democratic winner in the lieutenant governor's race, Justin Fairfax. For those who have not been following that race as closely, what can you tell us about Justin Fairfax?
Well, Justin and I are very good friends. I think he's a tremendous addition, a positive addition to our ticket. He's young. He's energetic. You know, he went to Duke down in North Carolina, then Columbia Law School. He has a wonderful family. We've become very good friends over the years, and we campaigned very well together. And I really think, you know, we have a great team in Justin, our Attorney General Mark Aaron, and myself, and we plan to be one solid team. We're going to have a very concise, definitive message for Virginia that we want to, you know, take Virginia to the next level. And I really look forward to campaigning with both of them. And also, Kojo and Tom, to, you know, having a coordinated campaign. I think we have a great opportunity in 2017 to win back our majority in the House of Delegates. And finally, you know, we can, as a party, get back on offense and stop playing so much defense.
Good. On that very subject, in Prince William County, transgendered ex-journalist Danica Rome won election in the Democratic primary against several other candidates. She got about 45% of the vote. She's going to be facing Delegate Robert Marshall, which will probably attract a great deal of attention. Where are you on that campaign?
Well, Danica and I have become good friends, and I'm glad
she's. Are you anybody that you're not a good friend with?
Gillespie.
Well, my best friends are Kojo and Tom.
Oh, no. I like to say we're friendly with everybody, but friends with no one.
But, you know, I think what Danica stands for is something that our party stands for, and that's inclusivity. And I would just tell you that it shouldn't matter one's sexual orientation, the color of their skin, the country they come from, or the religion they practice. We welcome people to the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I think she's a good ambassador for that message.
Well, I want you to know, I was looking at her campaign. She is very interested in the state doing something about Route 28, which is a nightmare travel highway through Manassas and other parts of Prince William and Fairfax.
On a discordant note, Mr. Lieutenant Governor, we got an email from Robert who said, Mr. Northam, as a medical professional, is surely aware of the Goldwater rule, yet he has repeatedly called Trump a narcissistic maniac. I'm no Trump fan, but not only is this unseemly, but it's also surprising that as the adult in the room, Mr. Northam is deliberately lowering the level of political discourse. I wonder if Mr. Northam has any comment, asks Robert.
I do, Robert. Number one, I think that our president is a very dangerous man. I think he's leading this country in the wrong direction on a lot of different issues that we have. And two, I would tell you just as I would encourage you to look up, it's called DSM-5. It's the book that we use in psychiatry to make diagnoses. And I would ask you to look up narcissism. And I would just say, if the shoe fits, ask Mr. Trump to wear it. And I think you'll find that the criteria for narcissism fit his personality quite well.
Ralph Northam, he is the lieutenant governor of Virginia. He won the primary to become the Democratic nominee in this November governor's race. Lieutenant Governor Northam, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Kojo, thank you so much. And Tom, if you can come this weekend, I can promise you that the room will be a little bit cooler than it was on Tuesday night.
I'm going to bring my personal fan.
Well, he has only one personal fan, actually, in the other sense of that term. But thank you once again for joining us.
Have a great day.
Thank you all so much.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Joining us in studio is Phil Mendelson. He is chair of the Council of the District of Columbia. He is a Democrat. Phil Mendelson, thank you very much for joining us.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Kojo.
There are a lot of issues that we'd like to get to, and you have quite a few issues on your agenda. But first, I'd like to take a moment to remember your former colleague, Councilmember Jim Graham, who passed away yesterday. A shock to many people. He was one of the more colorful characters in D.C. politics, known for his linen suits, his bow ties. You and he started on the council on the same year.
Same day.
What are some of your reflections of serving with him?
Well,
I remember because I emceed that inauguration when both you and he joined the council.
That was very long inauguration. Was that your fault?
No, it was actually the fault of one at-large council member who was then a Republican who shall remain nameless. But right. Go ahead.
And criticize some folks unnecessarily.
Back to Jim Graham, quite a character.
I think it's very sad. You know, I don't think of him as being a character, even though press me, I will agree. But, you know, he left the council 3 years ago, not by his own will. He was defeated in the primary. And I know he was looking forward to much more of a life than 3 short years and dying this way. He'd been sick with an infection, as I understand
it. A C. diff kind of infection that attacks your intestinal organs, I'm told, when none of the doctors here. But.
So it's all very sad and unfortunate. Jim was a very committed person, and even though he was able to drive some people crazy, he also was a fierce advocate of issues like homelessness.
Tenants' rights. And I know he always fought in the metro to try to keep the bus fares down. He said just too many people have to ride the bus, and it's not like the rail system, which is several dollars. He said people have to be able to ride. But even before he was on the council, and I did my story about him this week, I went over to the Whitman Walker Clinic, which is a thriving organization on 14th Street. But he ran it for 16, almost 17 years.
He was the Whitman Walker Clinic.
And he built it. And without it, right through the horrific HIV/AIDS, worst days of the crisis, when some people were turning a blind eye and some people prejudicially wouldn't do anything, he was fighting that battle.
Yes. The Whitman Walker Clinic was, I think, I may get in trouble for saying this. I want to say that was the place that took care of people who were dying of HIV/AIDS, and everybody died of HIV/AIDS in the early years.
Don Blanchard, who runs it now and has since, I think, for 2011 or so, said that without Graham, it would not be anything like what it is. And, of course, it's expanded now with much broader services to a whole variety of people. But it's still a core issue because HIV/AIDS is still a major public health issue, particularly in the African-American community.
Yes. Jim was an unabashed liberal, and he was willing to tax and spend. But his commitment to social services and helping those who were particularly needy was, unquestioned.
And Jim and I happen to share a barbershop, a very important place for people to share because conversations take place in the barbershop. And whenever Jim Graham was in the barbershop, invariably he would be the leader of the conversation in the barbershop. However, about 6 months ago when I encountered him in the barbershop, he was uncharacteristically silent. Yeah. And I realized then that he had begun to feel not very well at that point in his life.
But I think it's important to remember, though, that he was the type of personality that could out-talk a barber.
One of those rare types who can out-talk a barber. We should also mention, of course, the passing of Vincent Gray campaign aide, Jeannie Clark Harris. She passed at the age of 79. She had pled guilty in 2012 to conspiring with millionaire Jeffrey Thompson to funnel hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Gray campaign back in 2010. But I think it's important to note the passing of Jeannie Clark Harris.
And just a sentence, before that illegal activity, she had a long life of public relations and mentoring young people in public relations. So she was not, her whole life is not that one horrible incident of campaign skullduggery.
Well, if you have questions or comments for Phil Mendelson, he is chair of the D.C. Council. You should call now, 800-433-8850. You can praise, you can denounce, you can ask, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream of the broadcast there and join it.
Can we get one question out of the way before you start asking the serious questions? Are you running for re-election as chairman?
Yes.
Have you filed the paperwork yet?
Not yet.
And are you going to have a big campaign announcement soon?
Never have.
I'm trying to fill in my calendar for the rest of the year.
I've never been one for big, grandiose campaign kickoffs. I just file the papers.
And when will that happen?
I'm planning it happening
before the summer recess?
This summer. No, not before the recess, but this summer.
Late summer.
Yeah. Big story this week. Evidence was made public of a council investigation into alleged corruption in the city's contracting process. Your colleague, Councilmember Mary Che, led that investigation. Mayor Bowser responded yesterday, rejecting the findings, saying that her office will not be initiating further investigation. The mayor called one of the more serious allegations, in particular, that a city employee had illegally leaked information about a competitor's bid to a specific developer, a wild accusation. What do you know about that?
Well, I know pretty much what everybody else knows since the committee released all of the documents and Mary Che.
Joined the committee to vote for that.
I did. I did join the committee to vote for, to make sure that the documents could be released. And then Councilmember Che added to that her conclusions, which was this 45-page report. So that's, I know what other people know, and those documents are all publicly available. I think that the allegations, which are contained in these transcripts and testimony of many people, so we're not just talking about one person who calls the council and says, I've got a complaint, I think are concerning, and I think they should be followed up.
By whom?
Well, I think that the mayor should do that.
And she said she won't do it.
The inspector general.
The committee, it's very unusual. A committee spends a lot of time on any issue, whether it's an oversight. Then they do a committee report. There was no committee report here. Mary Che publicly complained, or didn't complain, told the Post that committee members had diluted her report, so essentially she didn't issue one. She issued her own report. It just seems like this is unfinished business. Admiral Chris Weaver, who was running the Department of General Services, abruptly quit. It was characterized as not that big of a deal by the Bowser administration, but it does seem to be a big deal. Should not the council call on ask the Inspector General to investigate rather than waiting to see if he does, or rather than just maybe somebody else? I don't know, the D.C. Auditor, Kathy Patterson. Is there somebody else can look into this and put maybe people under subpoena them or something and find out what the hell happened?
Well, I agree with you that it is. It feels like unfinished business, and I think it is unfinished business. I think the council committee took it as far as it could with numerous closed-door interviews and then releasing all that documentation. If the inspector general isn't going to take it up, but my impression from today's paper is that the inspector general is looking at this, or may not mean they're taking it up, then yeah, I think we should call for them to.
I know the mayor was focused at the convention center yesterday on the announcement of the arrest warrants for those people involved in the turkey stuff. But I was standing there when Peter Jameson from the Post asked her several times to respond to the report, and it really was, she just dismissed it almost out of hand.
Well, yeah. And
have you spoken with, you have lunch with her once a week. Have you spoken with her about this?
I meet with her once a week. Did you say lunch? I don't.
I thought it was lunch.
No.
Okay. Well, that's the part of the chill.
We're more low cost than that.
Okay, well, good. Have you spoken with her about this?
Very briefly, she raised it with me yesterday.
And what was that?
And her question had to do with council process. But I think that I think it's a mistake to dismiss what's going on. It may be.
Well, we should tell our listeners what is going on.
Well, here's the deal. Well, the Department of General Services was getting contracts to prepare the land in southeast near for the Wizards basketball facility and the soccer site in southwest. And Fort Myer, a major company in the city.
And major contributor to the
mayor's campaign. I know, but in terms of money, yes, they're heavily involved in the city's politics. Let's leave it that way. The contracts were not going to Fort Myer, and Chris Weaver, the head of the General Services, was sending them somewhere else, and it looked like the city administrator got involved and tried to steer them back to Fort Myer and then gave them some other contracts or additional money when they didn't get it. So, and he's denied any wrongdoing. The mayor says she hasn't done anything. But it's a mess, and Admiral Weaver had a good reputation.
But there was also evidence that Fort Myer construction got very detailed confidential information about a bid from a competing company.
That's right.
Which, if true, is illegal because in the procurement, information, well, proprietary information is confidential.
Let's don't get too much in the weeds, but yes, there was an indication that Fort Myer had knowledge of the other, another bidder, but we don't know yet who that person was. And I guess Mary Che didn't know, or she would have said, who the person or who leaked that information to the other bidder. So as we said at the start, this is unfinished business.
Yeah, and I think that the allegation
is... Chris Weaver quit. I mean, he said, I'm not going to do this. He told the city administrator, I'm not going to fire my deputies. They were asking to fire the two people under Chris Weaver, the city administrator was, because apparently thought they had mishandled this contract award. But, you know, he said, I'm not doing it. He walked out the door.
So the allegations may or may not prove to be true. But they're certainly credible based on the amount of documentation and the witnesses in the record.
The facts may not be illegal, but the facts are there.
So to me, the bottom line is that our procurement process has to be viewed with the utmost integrity. And right now there are questions around
right.
it. And to
Will
me,
you ask the inspector general to do it?
Hold on a second. So to me, it's not just, you know, what happened with the soccer stadium or with the Wizards practice facility contract. It is there something going on with procurements? And I think it's in everybody's interest to either reveal that something's is wrong and it's being fixed and some folks are going to be punished, or to reveal that, in fact, the allegations are without basis. And that
to provide evidence that the allegations are without
basis.
But that's the inspector general.
I mean, that's we're seeing this on the national stage. It's better to get the facts out and look at it and see what's going on, and everybody understands.
Well, I hope the inspector general, if he takes on this, there's some complaints to the inspector general's office. It's not as it has to do a thorough job, but it doesn't often move as quickly as some people would like.
The council passed the second and final 2018 budget earlier this week, not much different than the near final one passed 2 weeks ago. But among the funding debates were education and whether to delay planned tax cuts and use that money for social programs. In the end, the council put more money into education than the mayor requested, and the tax cut stayed in the $13.9 billion budget. The vote was unanimous. Were you satisfied with it? Why am I asking such a silly question?
Well, it was I put together, listening to colleagues, put together a consensus recommendation. Yes, I'm satisfied with what we did. I think what we did in the area of education was very important. There was a task force that had been pulled together by the executive that reported,
by the mayor.
Reported earlier this year that the funding formula per student should go up 3.5%, and the budget that was submitted to the council had it going up only 1.5%. The council, through its work, the Education Committee, David Gross, who chairs that, was able to increase it, and then my final recommendation was able to increase it further so that rather than a 1.5% increase, it's a 3% increase in that funding formula.
That's a pretty good increase.
Yes, and on top of that, assuming that there will be a collective bargaining agreement with the teachers, those dollars will be additional, which means that the percentage increase over the current year will be even greater than 3%. I think that's good. It gets more money to the classrooms, and we made it clear that the 3% that we voted on is to go to the classrooms, not the compensation agreements, and the compensation agreements would be additional. We did some other things that affect education. Child care subsidies, expanded those and increased the subsidy, and subsidized transportation for adult learners. We did that. We get a small increase for the University of the District of Columbia. There were a number of things we did to help with public education.
Let's talk about streetcars.
Please do, because funding an extension of the streetcar eastward towards 7 ended up being a point of disagreement in the budget. Ultimately, after some pressure from Mayor Bowser and Councilmember Vincent Gray, Mayor Bowser and Councilmember Vincent Gray together?
That's a new dynamic duo.
Exactly. Well, I would
funding was restored.
But here's the deal.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with your character.
Before we get into the weeds on this, and you have such detailed knowledge, it's hard to get to the big picture.
Tom, I've been big picture all afternoon, but thank you very much.
I know, but you have the here's the deal. First, I want to ask you, we have the streetcar on 8th Street.
Yes.
And there are discussions about sending it down into Anacostia, out to Benning Road to Minnesota, or wherever.
To Georgetown.
Georgetown and all of that.
Yeah.
You scared people by not putting some money in for the streetcar as much nearly as the mayor's budget initially said. And you put some money in, but not nearly what she suggested. Where is your overall picture, your picture, on what we should do about streetcars? Are they part of the transportation future of the city, or are they, is 8th Street an anomaly?
I know some folks say that it is part of the transportation future of the city. I think it hasn't proven itself yet.
It has not proven
itself. Has not proven itself yet. And I got to tell you that I go to community meeting after community meeting after community meeting in wards 4 and 3 and 7 and 8 and all over the city, and people are very critical, even angry about the streetcar and how much money we've spent. I think that the segment that's been nearly built, that is 8th Street and Benning Road to Oklahoma Avenue, ought to be finished. And then we'll see how effective it is. I know some folks say, well, we'll spend all the $1 billion or whatever it would be, you know, just to build another 2.8 miles, that is, from Oklahoma Avenue to the Benning Road metro station will cost $200 million. $200 million. So to build all 37 miles, I don't know how much, but some people say we've got to spend all of that, and then we'll see that the system actually works.
In my understanding,
that's way too expensive, and we've got way too many other priorities. So let's complete. My vision is to complete this segment. I've been very clear over and over. This system, this segment should complete at Union Station, which is not a very good connection right now, and complete at the metro station east of the river.
On Minnesota Avenue.
On Minnesota. Well, no, I think it's the Benning Road at East Capitol Street. And at least we have a complete segment, and let's see how it works. And we can always come back and extend it to Georgetown if we want. But as I said, we're spending a lot of money on this, and it's unpopular.
What about the Georgetown to Roslyn gondola? It's my understanding that there's money to take the next steps there.
There is a very small amount of money. There's $250,000. Compare that with just completing...
Million.
Yes, $200 million for the streetcar. Compare
what's that money? I like Mary Che's idea of the hot air balloon that she proposed in her farcical budget
that she puts out
every year.
Well, I think you should have some folks who are proponents of the gondola come in and speak to it and put the questions to them.
What are we going to do? What's the $200,000 for? Is that
$250,000. I think it's
to... Study. That
yeah,
like
it's
study
to do
now.
Some
I
of the...
there was already a study that Roslyn...
Hey, we
that,
do
that
studies
Georgetown
about
did.
Studies.
We need to do a study on how many studies there are.
Exactly. Well, we could do that. You want us to put money in the budget for that,
If you fund
too?
Me, I'll do it.
You'll need to offer some clarification.
I'm cheap, Tom, so...
We got an email from Greg in Petworth. I would like to ask Chairman Mendelson if he will commit to allowing private donations to fund the stipend program envisioned in the Neighborhood Engagement Achieves Results or NEAR Act, about which I know little or nothing. While I am thankful that most of the NEAR Act will be fully funded in FY18, the stipend provision was eliminated. Will Council Chair Mendelson support Councilmember McDuffie's amendment?
Well, I supported every amendment that either Mr. McDuffie or Charles Allen, as chair of the Judiciary Committee, put forward with regard to the NEAR Act. My last conversation was we believe that the subject to appropriations language, which stood in the way of whether the bill could be implemented, is being removed. That is to say that we fully funded the bill. Whether there's enough money in there, for instance, for stipends, I don't know. But there were portions of that act that could not be implemented until they were funded, and they are now funded with the FY18 budget.
I wanted to ask you about another issue that Tom brought up earlier, and that is the D.C. authorities announcing criminal charges against the Turkish security detail that was involved in that unpleasant incident that happened here in front of the Turkish embassy. It would appear that bringing these charges is intended to send a message, but can it do anything beyond that? Because according to the reports, law enforcement and legal experts, according to the Washington Post, have said bringing the attackers to justice could be difficult because Turkey is unlikely to extradite suspects or make them available for interviews.
Yeah, from what I know, it's pretty apparent that there were crimes that occurred, that people who were lawfully demonstrating were not just stopped, but were assaulted by these so-called security officials from the embassy.
Kicked in the head. I mean, the video is vicious. It was vicious.
Yes. These situations, meaning any time there's an allegation of a crime involving a foreign government, gets quickly involved with the State Department. I'm assuming that MPD has worked with the State Department.
Yes,
I don't
they
know,
said they did.
I don't know what the next step is. The District of Columbia has the ability to, you know, through the police, to arrest folks, but we don't have the ability to deal with international, you know, diplomatic immunity. And
well, they could be
so
arrested should they try to come back into the country.
Correct.
And also Chief Peter Newsom, who spoke at the mayor's press conference at the convention center, put out fresh video on YouTube of some people they're still trying to identify. And they said that Mayor Bowser was saying, it's, and the chief did too, it's important whether, in fact, these people ultimately get to prosecution and be charged for their crimes. It's important for people to know, no matter who they are, when they come to the District of Columbia, that you can't bring your thugs with you.
Well, I agree.
And that's basically what they were saying.
There are many values in the District of Columbia, and one of them is that we are a place where a lot of folks from around the country come to protest, exercise their First Amendment rights, and they should be able to do that freely.
My only criticism of the mayor for doing this press conference at the convention center, which drew a huge international press corps, is that she did it at the convention center. Had I been the mayor, I would have been at the where the crimes took place, right there on Sheridan Circle across from the Turkish
ambassador's residence.
It would have been, I think it would have had more impact.
Well, yes.
Blood was spilled on the street there.
I don't.
That would have been a place I would have been.
I agree with you, and I think this is an important issue. The ability to exercise First Amendment rights is important, and in the District of Columbia, we value that. But I think the bigger issue this week is the budget and what we've done with
it now goes to Congress
priorities.
For review. Do you expect any parts of it to be challenged?
Of the spending, no.
Okay.
But we always run the risk of these riders on gun control. What did I read in the paper? A rider on something else, which I didn't think was a federal issue.
Well, Congressman this weekend, in the wake of the Alexandria shooting, said that he wanted the district to allow guns in the city. Of course, several members of Congress have proposed that, including the congressman from Louisiana who's in the hospital.
Let's just think
about
it. Let
me interrupt because there are listeners who would like to speak with you. Here's Laura in Arlington, Virginia. Laura, your turn.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. Mr. Mendelson, I am a worker in D.C. I've worked in D.C. for 20 years. And I'm very concerned about secondhand smoke outside. Every time I take a walk, a break, a lunch break, I am faced with, you know, cigarette smoke everywhere. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about how to address this issue. I think it would make D.C. a much nicer place to be.
We know Rockville just passed an ordinance outlawing smoking outside at bars and restaurants.
But not sidewalks.
I'm not sure from the caller's question. What is she talking about, just prohibiting smoking anywhere outside?
Yes. Isn't that what you're saying, Laura?
Well, or providing spaces that are designated. If we had designated outdoor smoking shelters like sort of like a bus shelter idea or something like that, so that people have a place to go, but that it's just not everywhere. I mean, it's just everywhere right now. When you walk around, you're just faced with people smoking left, right, front, back.
You know, I don't mean any disrespect, but that's just not my experience. I do notice when somebody is smoking.
I think it's more noticeable because it is more unusual. When
I would agree.
You walk into somebody's puff of smoke. You know, I know of a place where, you know, there's a specific screened-in place where people smoke at our place, outside, where you have to go outside in this little whatever it's called, hut. I think it should be rebuilt in the shape of a coffin because I'm just a really anti-smoky person. But I don't think in a free society, how people walking through parks and streets and stuff like that in their cars smoking, it's just, I think he's got more questions.
Let me put a little perspective on that, and that is that we have, smoking in this country has declined enormously because of the public education
campaign. That's why it's so annoying when you encounter it.
Yes, but we've been very effective at reducing smoking. Now, I get that it's obnoxious, but at some point we have to balance, do we want to go the route that we've seen as discredited with illegal criminalizing various drugs and go that route with cigarettes? Or do we recognize that we actually have achieved considerable gains just through public education in reducing smoking?
We're almost out of time, but I'd like to get Eric in Manassas, Virginia, with this comment. Eric, your turn.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. Hey, I just take exception with what Tom Sherwood was saying about where the press conference was held. I mean, what actually happened on the streets of D.C. was incredible. I've never seen anything like that. So where the conference was held, it just seems to me just to be kind of a feat. Who cares?
Oh, well, the only reason I care is because I think the mayor made a dramatic, strong point on the behalf of the people of the city, that, and I think the point would have been even stronger with the Turkish ambassador's residence where the president of Turkey had watched these people being beaten. I just think it would have been more strong. That's the only reason that I thought the press conference otherwise was fine. Can we talk about paid family leave?
You got
leave?
A future as a flack, you think so?
Paid family, paid family leave?
What about
are you going to ever fund it? When is it going to be?
Oh, it's funded.
It's in the budget?
Yes, we funded the startup costs.
Are employees going to now have to pay half the cost instead of workers?
That was not what we passed.
But you passed very quickly.
But we are looking at the financing mechanisms and whether there are ways to improve.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but it's my understanding that last week you met with the mayor of Mexico City.
Yes.
Why?
He was visiting. He wanted to meet with me. I think he later met with the mayor. I think it's important. And when we have visiting officials, dignitaries, that our government is open and responsive. That was why. And there's a connection between us and Mexico City. You know, there are a lot of Hispanics in Washington, D.C., from more than just Mexico. There are, the folks in Mexico and elsewhere are very, very nervous about the federal policies, and we have an open door.
And I'm afraid that's it for the show today.
What about the Attorney General suit against Trump?
There's always more happening online and in person. On Tuesday, author Roxane Gay sits down with WMU's editorial director, Alicia Montgomery. Roxane Gay will talk about her new memoir, Hunger, A Memoir of My Body. That's Tuesday evening, 6:30, All Souls Unitarian Church. It's free, but you'll need to RSVP. For more information, go to WAMU.org/events. Be sure to meet us back here at noon Monday. We'll be talking with the author of a new book about the first African-American students at the University of Virginia. Mr. Council Chairman, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Tom, you have a great weekend.
I intend to.
You all have a great weekend. Happy Father's Day, and thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Avery Kleiman, and Taria Rogers. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nandi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.